On this episode of Skeptico,
I wonder if we miss something when we try and get too technical with the slide rule science. You know, the slide rule science where we're just going, well, it must be this, it must be this, it must be this. When at the edges, we realize how little we don't know when we really look at the broader spectrum of, be it Bengtsson or what Wim Hof does, or, you know, somebody who has a near-death experience and as part of the experience goes through a healing of some other ailment, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of those stories.
Well, doctors, I mean, they believe that if you can make yourself sick, like I think it's called like a Takotsubo cardiomyopathy or broken heart syndrome, where the heart can weaken itself literally from severe mental stress. So they believe in that, but yet they don't believe that possibly from a spiritual standpoint or a metaphysical standpoint or whatever you want to call that, a person could will themselves to get better. I've known it to happen, and it's happened.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Hi, everyone. I have an interview coming up in a minute with John Brisson about Fix Your Gut and about how our stomach is kind of the driving engine for a lot of health issues. There's a lot of skeptical issues around this that I think are interesting, and we explored a little bit. For example, if everything is consciousness, why do we even bother with health? Or why do we bother so much, especially someone like me who winds up kind of doing and trying a lot of different health-related things? Why bother? World, what world kind of thing? So that's one topic. And on the more conspiratorial side, why does it so often seem like our medical establishment is conspiring against our health and sometimes seem to be driving us over the cliff with advances in technology? So those are a couple of things that we get into, but mainly we talk about how fixing your gut can really improve your health. Hope you enjoy my chat with John Brisson. Today we welcome John Brisson to Skeptico. John is the author of Fix Your Gut, The Definitive Guide to Digestive Disorders. And although that might not seem like a natural fit with some of the topics we cover here on Skeptico, I can tell you that after listening to many hours of interviews with John, reading his excellent book, and even hiring to do a consult with a member of my family, boy, I can tell you, you're in for a treat. I can assure you that John is in the right place here on Skeptico. It's great to have you, John. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Alex. I'm a huge fan of the show. Love what you do at Skeptico. Enjoyed many of your interviews, especially when you asked the tough questions, like asking Jim Morris point blank if he was a Scientologist. yeah, definitely thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to be here, and it is great to know someone who is familiar with the show and have him on as a guest, because as we were talking about beforehand, you know, I do have some, you know, just skeptical kind of questions. I ask the stuff that I'm really curious of, and especially since you've done some excellent interviews out there that people can find. The interview you did with Greg on the Higher Side Chats is great. Grimerica was great. I know you've done other ones, but I have questions that maybe some people haven't heard of before, and they are genuine concerns and areas of interest to me. So I've sent you some of those in advance, and I think we're going to have some fun.
Yes, very much so. I enjoyed the questions that you sent me. It'd be good for us to challenge each other. I enjoy it. You know, that's one of the lost arts of podcasting. It seems that less and less people want to get into, you know, civil debate, but at least discussion, I guess, if you want to call it, you know, and that's why I love Skeptico so much, because you are willing to ask the tough questions.
Great, great.
And be a skeptic.
I always call them one-offs. You know, I go, that person will never talk to me again, but that's okay. At least I got that interview in there. But, you know, let's kind of start with the main thing that people are going to want to know from the beginning is an intro of you, who you are, and how you got into all this. Fix Your Gut.
Yeah, Alex. Well, my name is John Brisson. My early 30s. Well, I guess if I go to start with how health became an interest of mine was I was sick a lot when I was a child. First off, I was born 3 months premature back in 1985. had asthma, had a lot of problems, a lot of issues growing up. Myself and other members of my family, which we'll talk about, they also had medical issues. My mother had systemic lupus. When she was pregnant with me, the doctors actually were asking her if she wanted to abort me because they didn't know how lupus was going to affect her during the pregnancy and didn't know how it was going to affect me later in life, you know, because I wasn't, you know, developed prematurely, possibly from her having lupus. And she was a staunch Catholic and she was totally against abortion. So she wanted to have me. And so, you know, from there, I had my own medical challenges that a lot of your listeners that probably have gone through with members of their family or with their own health. And my mom sadly passed away when I was very young, when I was 7, from complications of lupus. She contracted bronchitis and her immune system could not handle it. And she passed away. And later, my father was actually one of the first people in the United States diagnosed with hepatitis C. In the late 80s, early 90s, he was one of the first people to get a ribavirin treatment for it at Duke University in the mid-90s. So I remember growing up helping take care of my father, especially when I was in high school, you know, him taking ribavirin and vomiting, you know, throughout the night, you know, not being able to sleep, crying from it making him so sick. Mm. And sadly, eventually, my dad ended up passing away right before I went to college. I was going to go to University of Charlotte for computer programming, had a nice scholarship to go there and a program that they had going at the time. And he died from, cirrhosis of liver complications of having hep C. So I guess that wasn't what was intended for me to actually do that because I had a mental breakdown about a month later and returned home and went to college, kind of shifted a little bit. I kind of thought about maybe going for biology at one point, maybe going for nursing school at FTCC. Neither one of those things ended up panning out. And I just worked odd jobs here and there. One time, actually, you might find this interesting, I worked as a role player for the United States government dressing up as an Arab, which was a very, very interesting job. But I got sick. Even though I had asthma, you know, I had a lot of health issues. My appendix burst when I was 14 and ended up being in the hospital for a month because I almost failed eighth grade and ended up having a hernia surgery afterwards and everything. I was pretty stable. I could eat what I want for the most part and not really feel too terribly bad. But around the time before my first son was born, about a month before, I started getting really sick. I started having silent reflux. I started dealing with extreme anxiety and extreme phobias that I never had before. I was like afraid of chemicals, developed chemical phobia. And it was weird. I got very ill and I couldn't really pinpoint exactly why. And later I figured out it was because I was taking Isinopril, which is an ACE inhibitor. It depletes zinc. And it led me to having an underfunctioning immune system and I got H. pylori.
You know, can we stop right there? And can you explain what H. pylori is? Because it might pop up a lot. I mean, this whole story is so fascinating because people might not know this at this point, and they might be hearing kind of these random, unbelievably really tragic things that have happened in your life. But your work now touches literally thousands and thousands of people with the same conditions you're talking about. But this latest one, I think, let's break that down because I've heard you mention it before. It's come up in my personal health situation, and let's break that down for people and then continue with the story because it's great stuff.
Yes, Alex. H. pylori is a bacteria. It's a gram-negative bacteria, Heliobacter pylori. It's generally found in the stomach. It was known as the cause of ulcers. For years, doctors thought that the cause of ulcers, and when we get to current medicine, we're going to talk about some of the issues, and this is one of them. It's kind of like a teaser. Researchers knew for about since the mid-1980s when Barry Marshall, who was an Australian researcher, he and Robin Warren, they both discovered that H. pylori was the cause of peptic ulcers, disease, and gastritis and reflux. Actually, Barry Marshall, no one believed him, drunk a concoction of H. pylori that he had cultured and gave himself ulcers and then treated it with antibiotics just to prove that it was the cause. And, you know, most people back then thought that the main cause of peptic ulcers was stress. And doctors were treating peptic ulcers mainly with just antacids. And it wasn't really until the early 2000s, the late 1990s, where doctors actually started treating ulcers as H. pylori infection with triple or quadruple antibiotic therapy. So it took a good 15 years for the research for the doctors actually to catch up and start treating the condition as what it is, which is H. pylori dysbiosis. There's been more information to come out about H. pylori. It can cause many possible – be the cause of many possible cause of many autoimmune diseases. Multiple sclerosis, for example, if H. pylori is able to colonize the brain or spinal cord, has been shown as cause of MS. Sjogren's syndrome, which is mainly characteristic by dry mouth and dry eyes, has been shown to be possibly caused by H. pylori. Gastric cancer. Has also been implicated to be caused mainly by H. pylori, colonization dysbiosis. So yeah, you know, H. pylori, it made me very – personally made me very ill. It made me have severe anxiety from ammonia production. It destroyed my life worse than actually than when I had sepsis when my appendix burst. Yeah, that might have been killing me, but it didn't rob me as much as my mental faculty or my life as much as the H. pylori chronic infection did later in my life, Alex.
You know, and John, let me just interject a quick little story from my own health that where it intersected with the H. pylori. And I shared this a few years ago on the show, but, you know, I'm pretty much one of these guys that don't like to go to the doctor kind of thing, which a lot of people can relate to. But I had this heart condition that was causing me to be really tired, and I finally broke down, went to the doctor. The doctor says, hey, it's all in your head. There's nothing there. So I went back. I still felt bad a few months later. I go to the doctor again. She puts the thing, and she goes, oh, my God, we got to get you to a cardiologist right away. You have AFib. You have this irregular heartbeat. It sounds really bad. We have to do something. So this was a few years ago, and luckily for me, my friend Barack Obama stepped in and had kind of screwed up everything with the Obamacare so that my insurance was going to cause me to have to wait 90 days to see the cardiologist and all the rest of this. So I had this little time, and I was able to kind of regain my composure and go, wait a minute, you know, I'm not about these doctors. I'll do it if I have to, but I want to look for everything possible. So I started doing my work, and the one bit of data that I came across was this study that was done by these gastrointestinal specialists in Italy who had discovered that people with H. pylori were 20 times more likely to have AFib than those who weren't. So they hadn't drawn any, you know, cause and effect, but they had said, gee, isn't this interesting, especially 20 times, not two times, not four times, 20 times. Armed with this data, I had this renewed vigor. I was going to go back and maybe the medical system establishment could help me now that I had some data, we had something we could target on.
Yeah.
I brought the study into the first doctor. She wouldn't even look at it. She dismissed it out of hand. I mean, this is like a story you tell somebody. Wouldn't even look at it. I printed it out. She says, no, it has nothing to do with what you're eating or anything like that. So doctor number two wouldn't look at it. Tries to prescribe me all these black box drugs. If anyone doesn't know, those are drugs that it says right on them can cause all these horrible side effects, and they're being given for off label. They're not even being prescribed for the FDA approved purpose, but by the discretion of the doctor. And I don't want to go on too far, but I didn't last very long at that doctor either. But what the guy told me at the end, and maybe this will pick up back with a story that you encountered as well. But the guy said, hey, I just want to make sure you're telling your wife, Because when the ambulance shows up at your door, I don't want her coming to me. And I just want to add that this guy was in a clinic that a very, you know, high-end clinic here in Southern California that promotes complementary medicine. So that was my experience. And then what I tackled and how I tackled it is going to fit in nicely with a lot of the stuff that you've discovered. And you are so brilliant on this stuff. You can talk for hours and tell people, and people will never get enough. I mean, you can talk forever. People never get enough. They're going to have to go check out your book and your website because you're so generous in sharing all this information. But I want you to, thanks for listening to that. I want you to pick back up with your story, because I think what you've gone through is really, it's terrible to hear that somebody's had to endure all that, but it's hard not to believe that there was some purpose in that, given the work that you're doing now, John. So tell us what happens after this, after you have this health crisis with H. pylori.
Yeah, well, one last thing, Alex, and I'll continue on that. It's known that H. pylori, as a gram-negative bacteria, produces endotoxins, and endotoxins are a main cause, when kept unchecked by our body, our main source of inflammation, you know, elevated hsCRP. So yeah, I mean, the study, the Italian study that you're referencing, being linked to AFib being a pathogenic link, it's because of the endotoxins and certain cytotoxins that H. pylori produces. And you see that with a lot of dysbiosis. So it's interesting that you brought this information to your doctor and they're just like, you know, whatever this, but if you took it to possibly a microbiologist, maybe with someone with an immunologist type background, they'd look at it and they go, well, yeah, you're probably right. So a similar thing happened to me. I had when I was going through my health issue, I had a doctor, tell me, that ubiquinol, didn't work, and that I was just wasting my money and, you know, my health and, you know, and everything, and laughed in my face when in Japan it's used for high blood pressure and heart failure by prescription. So it's just that ignorance is astounding. And I was sick, you know, for a long time. Got out of H. pylori about 2 or 3 years ago once I finally figured out that was what it was. But my main trials that I had with the medical establishment was with my middle child, Abel. My wife, when she was pregnant with him, she started developing polyhydramnios, which she had carried around a lot of fluid. And they did a ultrasound around the 32-week mark and noticed that he wasn't moving very much at the time. And they could really give us no reason why. His heart was beating, but he wasn't moving. So they had no idea of the extent of what was happening. So my wife later had a C-section because they're afraid that he may not survive the natural vaginal birth. And when he was born, he was extremely contracted. Both of his arms and hands were turned inward. He could barely make an audible cry. So they rushed him off to the intensive care unit. And so we had no idea what was going on. They've never seen anything like this before. And so eventually they were working to try to get him transferred to UNC Chapel Hill. And I remember, you know, he was on the ventilator, he was in the ICU, the head, pediatrician, head of the neonatal unit at the local hospital, came up to me and we were talking and everything. And, you know, he was like, well, do you want to move him to Chapel Hill or do you want to take him off the ventilator? And I was like, well, let's move him to Chapel Hill at least till we get a diagnosis of what it is. He's not getting any worse, you know. And the doctor looked right at me and he said, well, as disabled as he is, he's probably better off dead. And I was shocked. I was taken back, you know. I was like, holy crap. I mean, my wife, you know, she started crying. And I mean, it took me everything not just to punch him, you know. I mean, I was livid, and I was shocked too at the same time. You know, how dare someone in the medical, and not all doctors are like that. Well, I'll get to that later in my own personal experience. But I was just knocked back. So, Abel gets transferred to UNC Chapel Hill. They start running some tests. We meet with one of his doctors who I will mention her because she was an excellent doctor. Her name was Jane Fan. My first meeting with her didn't go very well either. But later she you know believed in me and she believed in Abel and she changed where she was a very, very brilliant woman. She was a neurogeneticist. A dual doctorate, and she said that the same thing, that Abel was going to die and there wasn't anything that anybody could do. But they were going to do a muscle biopsy and maybe they can figure out what he has, and they were going to send off to the Mayo Clinic. So they did, and at the same time, he was still not changing much at all. It's been about 3 or 4 months at that time. We were staying at the Ronald McDonald House, and they got the diagnostic back. One doctor had seen it before and or something similar to it, which is Costello syndrome, which is another HRAS gene mutation disease. And he was like, I've only seen one other case of this ever. And it's only a handful of cases in the medical literature. My son was 6 diagnosed in the world with it. The name of the condition is congenital myopathy with excess muscle spindles. It doesn't even have a fancy syndrome name or anything, or a person discovered. It's just what it is. And so they told us he was going to die. Most kids with Costello's die from heart failure. And there was nothing that could be done. And my wife and I talked about it for a long time and I didn't want him to suffer. You know, I didn't really think I knew some things at that point, not nearly as much as I knew now, but I didn't know, Alex. I didn't know what really could be done for him. So we made the decision that we didn't want him to suffer. That at least maybe we can have him breathe on his own and, you know, he can die with us, you know. So we were going to take out the ventilator. So around that time, nothing that could be medically explained occurred. He spit out his breathing tube, his intubation tube, and he could actually breathe better off the intubation tube than on. And there is still no medical explanation of why that would have happened, because his chest muscles, his lungs, all that should have atrophied while he was on the ventilator, because they were being, you know, not used properly. But yet there he was. So they go, well, you could take him home. So we took him home and he was under hospice, and we eventually got him off of hospice. And we started taking care of him. So I started, you know, talking to Dr. Fan. I'm like, look, let's try some things. So we started put him on CoQ10. We put it on magnesium, and she was reluctant at first, but eventually, you know, I showed her the data and she was like, sure, let's do this. You know, she came from China. She saw, you know, Chinese medicine work for people in her own family, as she had mentioned to me. So she was like, fine, let's do this. So we started to do it. And Alex, he started to get better. I mean, he wasn't ever going to be 100%. You know, he had a lot of physical issues that would have caused him problems that he may not have been able to overcome fully, like the contractures or the muscle weakness to some degree. But his heart had become stronger, his blood pressure had become normal, and he started gaining weight, and he was becoming a normal boy. And then he was adding a feeding tube, and we started giving his own formula, and he lost a little bit of weight. And one of the nutritionists was like, well, he's losing a little weight. We don't know if you're really feeding him, even though we told her that the nurses documented that we fed him and everything. He's being fed properly. And so they pretty much was like, we're going to have to contact, you know, the hospital social worker, you know, if he doesn't gain weight, you need to increase his feed. We were scared. I should have told her just to screw off at the time, but I didn't.
So they basically were intimidating you. They had given your son, they had given up hope on him, they had given him to you to die at home, and then they wanted to jump in again when some Mickey Mouse protocol that they thought should be in place wasn't there. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and he was actually he was doing well. You know, I mean, by their standards, other than his weight was a little bit off. But even Dr. Fan, you know, we talked about it and she was like, well, it's normal for people with his condition to have failure to thrive and his weight's not that off, you know. And we were adjusting his formula to the homemade formula and that's normal. But yet the nutritionist was still pushing it. And so we put him back on the standard formula and he started having really bad breathing problems. And I figured it out that it was aspiration because he was overfeeding, but they didn't ever look at it as that. They thought it was his muscular condition was getting worse, that he was regressing. And so we've spent months in and out of the hospitals. He had to be intubated and put on a ventilator. He almost died from it before. But eventually I finally convinced them yet again that, you know, aspiration was his problem from being overfed. So once I convinced them that, after him, you know, regressing because of it, we took him home. And at that point, I said, I'm done, Alex. I'm done. He hasn't got any vaccinations. They didn't want him to get vaccinations because of his precarious condition, ironically, because they didn't know his state. And they were afraid that if he gave him vaccinations, it could cause him harm. And it's just – it's ironic, you know, that it baffles my mind about modern medicine and how they treat everybody and how they treated him. And I feel like I felt him in a lot of ways, you know, because even though when I got him back and I got him back on his regimen and he started, you know, getting sun and he actually started recovering, Alex, he was about to get off the ventilator. They were going to start teaching him how to speak. His heart was working phenomenal. No signs of heart failure whatsoever. He one night out of the blue had a pulmonary embolism from the previous trauma that he had when they intubated him and being on the ventilator, and he died.
That's so sorry to hear that, and that's such a hard thing. I've never gone through that, so I can't even pretend to know what that's like. But quite a story, unbelievable.
And one last thing. His heart, when we took him up, because I didn't want him to die inside the hospital room, so they allowed us to take him up to the top of the hospital, and they had a garden, and he can die, you know, with dignity, you know, not hooked up to machines. His heart beat for a good 10 to 15 minutes, even when he wasn't breathing oxygen. It was so strong from the ubiquinol and the PQQ that I'd given him, and the red light LED therapy that increases mitochondrial health. The magnesium and everything. And I think without that pulmonary embolism, I think, you know, and this is all theoretical, I think without him being overfed or aspirating, I think that he could have still been alive today. You know, I do want to think, you know, like I said, there are some good doctors. Dr. Fan was always his strongest advocate once it was shown that he could beat it. And once, you know, the things that we had worked together on actually worked for him. And on his medical case study, I am listed as an expert. And there is thanks to me, you know, if anybody listening, their child does have CMEMS, don't hesitate to reach out to me.
Let's talk about that. Who reaches out to you now at this point? I mentioned that you've helped thousands of people. And, you know, after reading your book and listening to you, I reached out. I hired you for a consult with my daughter, you know, who was having a certain condition. I wasn't even going to mention that it was my daughter, but there it slipped out. That's okay. But who's reaching out to you? What are some of the common problems that people experience that they feel you can help them with? And I guess the flip side or the other side of that is, what problems can you help people with most frequently?
It ranges anywhere from SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth syndrome, any type of reflux, whether it's silent reflux or gastrointestinal reflux, you know, issues like that, all the way to chronic Lyme disease. I've coached people with chronic Lyme disease. I've coached people with MS. It varies, you know. Most people, because I'm fixed your gut, they do come to me for general gut issues. But a lot of people don't realize is our microbiome has a lot to do with our health. And a lot of these quote unquote autoimmune conditions, whether it's lupus, which is more than likely caused by staph, or MS, which is more than likely caused by H. pylori and viral reactivation of herpes virus, viruses like varicella. A lot of that has to do with our gut health, and a lot of them are linked together with one another.
So, yeah, and I think that's something we just can't emphasize enough, but people have to dig in there and kind of find some of these little threads and then follow them through. But the gut is really the driving engine for so much of your health. And even if some, I'd encourage people, if you have issues at all related to overall health, just take a look at Fix Your Gut and see if there's something that John has written or posted that might give you a window into what's going on. And of course, you know, John isn't the sole source. And I think John is really open to, he references a ton of other people in his work, and he definitely encourages people to do all the research on your own, you know, but he's a tremendous resource. Here's my next point, though, and the question I think that a lot of people, maybe more of a skeptico person, would kind of ask, but who's to blame? Who's to blame for this? I mean, it's outrageous. On one level, it's just outrageous that a doctor would tell grieving parents that their son is better off dead. I mean, this isn't a medical issue. Your value judgment, your moral judgment about, you know, how the world works and the balance of a soul in God's hand and all the rest of that. Well, where do they even get the idea that they're in the ballpark to answer that? So, you know, that's one who's to blame. But the other is, who's to blame about just the big problems we see in medicine? What are your first reactions to the who's to blame question?
Well, I mean, depends. If I'm going to get conspiratorial, I guess we could talk about the Rockefellers. The main reason why the modern medicine system is the way it is today. Or, I mean, like I've mentioned before, I think most doctors, it's ignorance. Some doctors, it's greed.
Let's stop at the Rockefellers. I mean, it's interesting that you start there. And actually, before we go to the Rockefellers, because I think that sends everyone on their heels right away. I mean, we've all heard the Rockefellers, and it's like, oh my God, conspiracy nut, I don't want to hear this anymore. You know, let's reverse the order. Let's start with the doctors, because you just said that the doctors are, you know, there's some good doctors out there, and most doctors care about patients, and that's why they got into the field and this and that. Hey, no, there's a lot of doctors put on that white coat and forget that they're human beings, or
very much so,
buy into the bullshit that they've been taught all through medical school and are so indoctrinated in a certain dogmatic belief that they are totally to blame. That doctor that I gave that study and she didn't look at it, she is to blame. There is no question. So
just like the head of the pediatric, you know, and many doctors, I had a doctor who told me that giving my son, that was sanctioned by Dr. Phan, 100 milligrams of magnesium would cause hypermagnesemia, and he'd become weaker because of that. And I just laughed in the doctor's face and said, no. And she was like, well, we give it to pregnant women with preeclampsia. And I said, yeah, you give IV magnesium sulfate at doses to cause, you know, muscle relaxation, reduction of blood pressure. To cause that exact symptom, me giving him 100 milligrams is not going to harm my son. So yeah, you are right. I will agree with you, Alex, that some doctors, it is downright greed. Some doctors, it's complete willful ignorance and stupidity. But there are some doctors who mean well, who just don't know any better. And there's some doctors who do try to do a more combination approach, integrative approach. And not everyone's going to get it right. You know, I Lord knows I haven't, you know, humans will make errors, but I agree with you that, I mean, when doctors go and we'll talk about, you know, how the modern structure of medical education came to be, but when doctors go to school, you know, it's all state sanctioned, AMA sanctioned learning material. They get very few, if any, education on nutrition, which you think would be very important for a doctor, you know, with health. You think nutrition would be something, but it's not. They don't actually get a lot of pharmacological knowledge either. My grandfather was a pharmacist, and he would talk about all the time how doctors would prescribe medicines that interact with each other, and they didn't know any better, which of course, I guess it's glad that they have a computer now who can tell them that there's an issue with drug interaction. But yeah, I mean,
The reason I think that doesn't always hit people in a way that they can get it is they know the work that doctors put in terms of medical school. And we know that they're absorbing a lot of stuff. And we know that the technology is advancing so rapidly that we kind of empathize with their situation. And I do too. I mean, you can only know so much. You can only work at learning all this stuff so much. So that's why I'm always a little bit not quite sure I can dive quite into the, you know, I get the nutrition thing that they're not given enough education in nutrition, but don't they have a lot that they have to learn just with all the advances in medicine and all the specializations? And isn't that part of the problem, or maybe not? I really don't know.
If I could do it as an autodidact, then they certainly could do it too.
Got a point there.
I'm sorry. I mean,
so you think the problems are more systemic in with the institutions? Is big pharma to play?
Very much so.
And that gets into the greed thing. I mean, I think your example with the ulcers is classic. And I you know, if you just walk through that, I just think through that from a business standpoint. You know, you're like, what would you do if you ran a multi-billion-dollar industry that was driven by antacids for ulcers, and all of a sudden some doctor came along and said, don't have nothing to do with that. It has to do with this other thing over here. I mean, some part of that system would want to protect itself from losing all that money. I mean, that's just a reality.
Oh, very much so. Same with, you know, it might not be the researchers at the bottom, but it's pretty sure the people who make the decisions at the top. I mean, I definitely agree with you on that 100%. I mean, you'll see it in many diseases. The supposed cause of ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, researchers have known for about 25 odd years now, seems to be Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis, which is a mycobacterium found in dairy cattle and ruminant animals. And I've helped a lot of people, some very close personal friends of mine who had ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, see tremendous recovery just by removing all ruminant animal products out of their diet instead of taking costly biological agents. I mean, those costly biological agents, they are worth a lot of money, and you got to be on them, you know, steroids and 5-ASA, you know, you got to be on that for the rest of your life. But if you make some dietary changes, maybe take some supplements, maybe some herbs, antibiotics sometimes are needed for people with severe MAP dysbiosis. But that's the thing is instead of, you know, people being the choice or get, that's the main problem with all this is there used to be a choice. There used to be a choice between allopathic medicine, naturopathy, homeopathy, and osteopathy. And then all of a sudden there isn't. And now you're left pretty much with allopathy, which is modern medicine, and you know, osteopathy pretty much follows under that. You know, osteopaths aren't even taught like they were previously in the past. You know, they're pretty much allopathic doctors at this point. So that's where it all came from. When we talk later, we talk about the Rockefellers, and I got enough evidence.
Talk about them now. I'm sorry that I took you off the Rockefeller thing. I don't have any problem with laying that truth bomb out there. So go ahead. Tell us about the Rockefellers.
All right. So the Rockefellers got involved pretty much with wanting to influence the modern medical establishment through many different methods. One was, you know, and most pharmacists will tell you this, that a lot of drugs are petrochemical based. And of course, the Rockefellers own Standard Oil. Now, just because a lot of medications are and a lot of things that we use in our daily lives are petrochemical based doesn't necessarily mean that they're 100% evil. And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you'll read sometimes online that a lot of drugs have many different benzene rings. Well, yeah, well, so do their aromatic amino acids. And you would ingest a lot of those in many protein food sources that you eat on a daily basis. You know, if you eat turkey, you're eating tryptophan. So it's the dose that makes the poison type aspect on all this. So some of the first drugs that were made, if we're not counting the ones that allopathic medicine used previously in the past, like mercury in the form of cinnabar or lead, which we all know are very toxic metals, we'll go with a lot of the petroleum derivatives around the time. I'm pretty sure you've heard of Tylenol, right?
Of course.
Acetaminophen. Well, acetaminophen isn't even the first drug that was developed. The first one that was developed was acetylide, and it was toxic. it caused methemoglobinemia, which is when you have too much iron-bounded hemoglobin in your body, and pretty much you turn blue from cyanosis and you die. And it can also cause cancer as well. But, you know, it was used first, and then later the derivative of that, Tylenol, which is acetaminophen, which was the metabolite of actinolide, it's not as poisonous. It doesn't, quote, more than likely doesn't cause cancer, but it still can cause liver damage, because to detoxify any of these an acetylide drug or phenacetin, which was also another drug that was from the same family that was they call them Kaltor derivative drugs, that was banned too in the late 80s by the FDA. Acetaminophen's still there. They can cause a lot of damage by the body. So acetaminophen, as most people might have known, you know, maybe they've seen an odd television report, it's been linked to liver damage. It used to say you could take around 5 to 6 grams per day and be safe. They've got that down to around 3 or 4 grams now. We don't know how much, you know, eventually they're going to, you know, I actually predict eventually that, and I might be wrong about this, but I do think acetaminophen will be withdrawn off the market in the next 20 or 30 years, just because it's so bad on the liver. But a lot of these medications, you know, were petrochemical derivatives. And a lot of that came from the oil. You know, Rockefeller had vested interest of, you know, if you're going to make drugs from petroleum and you are one of the most wealthy people in the world and you own American Standard Oil, then where are they going to come get the resources, the raw materials to produce medications?
I hear you on that. I mean, that's just kind of tricky because we can't always tie all the cause and effects down. And I mean, they were involved in a lot of other things too. I certainly don't want to paint a halo around their head. It just seems to me that the acceleration of that in the last 30 or 40 years certainly doesn't seem to have anything to do with the Rockefeller influence. It seems to me just to be more of this capitalism, and I'm all for capitalism, but kind of this crony capitalism gone awry, where it's hard to not come to the conclusion that the real agenda is to get everyone on medication for life, purely for the economic benefit of that for the pharmaceutical companies.
And I agree with you, but to push back on that, there's more than just the petrochemical involvement in medicine. There's
right,
the Flexner
and
there's education, which the Flexner report with Abraham Flexner, which was put forth by Andrew Carnegie, the Carnegie Foundation, and as well as Rockefeller's involvement into it as well, pretty much destroyed homeopathy colleges, naturopathic colleges. It was a report that pretty much laid out how with working with the AMA of how doctors, you know, the amount of schooling that they should get, the trusted institutions of learning in the different states, the ones that met the seal of approval for you know, by Flexner himself. I mean, Flexner's mentor was William Welk, who was a Skull and Bones Yale member. Mm-hmm. Who worked with, you know, at John Hopkins, and John Hopkins, of course, now is one of the, you know, biggest hospitals and medical universities in the known world. You know, so pretty much any college that was good enough to be on this list, medical institution, they made it, and the rest did not. Now, I've read the Flexner report, and a lot of it is just horse crap. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we could even if you want to really talk about the sad things that came out of there, if you want to, other than the destruction of other forms of medicine, is that African Americans really got a poor deal out of the Flexner report, because they were pretty much left with only two colleges in the United States, one of them being Howard, that were able to give degrees to African Americans to practice medicine because of it. So they closed the five other schools that were there. As well as is Flexner believed that African Americans were not smart enough to practice surgery, that they should only be taught hygiene. I mean, Say what you will, but that's...
No, you got me, man. I'm on the ropes. I'll give up on defending.
I mean, the same. I mean, we could talk about homeopathy colleges, like the Hahnemann Institute that was set up and that was made in Philadelphia, which I was actually in Philadelphia last weekend for vacation, and I saw the Hahnemann Institute. Now it's a standard allopathic college, sadly. They sold out. But they were allowing women to, as they should, to become doctors and learn lectures and everything in the mid to late 1800s. And because of the Flexner Report, because so many medical colleges were closed, the rest pretty much just focused on men becoming doctors. So women were forced out.
Hey, here's the next thing I wanted to just bring up. It's a very practical thing. One of the things I get from your work is that you do rely on numbers. So on a very practical basis, I wanted to ask you, what tests do you recommend that people do on themselves in order to get a handle on where their health is really at? So we've already said that, you know, if you go through your doc in the box down the road, you never know what's going to happen. Where do you tell people to start in terms of grounding themselves with the numbers related to their health?
Well, for most people, unless you have an integrative gastroenterologist, they're not going to run any complex gut testing like GIFX or anything to really get the numbers. So if people can really get a good idea of what their microbiome looks like, there's two tests that are offered that the average person can purchase. One is a U-biome test. It costs about $80 or $90. It does a standard PCR, genome testing of their gut. No test is 100%. None of them are. But your biome isn't too terribly bad for the cost, and you can get a good idea of what your gut microbiome makeup is. The other more costly test is the Viome test. It's well worth the price for the test. It's about $400. You get a more in-depth profile. You get a diet that you can follow that your gut microbes should like and things that should improve your gut health based off of your microbiome results. My only caution to Viome is that it's run out of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. So I'm putting my tinfoil hat on again. The government would have probably access to your genome of your microbiome, which the genome of the microbiome, your microbiome does shift a little bit on a daily basis, depending on your diet, because most people don't eat the same thing every day, Alex.
So is that something that you recommend, John? Because one of the things I want to interject is doing those tests, because one of the things that I want people to know that they'll find when they read Fix Your Gut is you're very pragmatic. I mean, you're the kind of the Tao of Fix Your Gut. You know, I mean, if you want to spend $20 a month, here's the book lays out a budgeted thing you can do. $30 a month, $40 a month, you know, you kind of, and you're very practical in terms of saying, okay, you know, here's what you start with first. Maybe this is where we should interject here is someone's listening to this and they say, that might be me if I just wanted to try something that's going to be good for my health anyway, that might fix some of these problems. Where do I start?
For most people, it's just a simple change of diet. I'd recommend picking up the book Perfect Health Diet by Paul Jaminet, reading that book and applying the diet. I mean, there's some things that you can do for free that I talked about and Fix Your Gut. Getting sunlight, for example, is pretty much free in the known world. It's just going outside and getting some sun. There's a recent study.
Talk about that for a minute. People will be surprised and amazed that the sun, vitamin D in the middle of the day is a good idea in reasonably controlled doses.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to get sunburned. Obviously, that will lead to, you know, oxidative stress will lead to cancerous cell formation. I mean, that happens with any strong amount of oxidative stress. But yeah, I mean, proper sunlight exposure is one of the few things that we don't do in the modern world. Our body produces vitamin D and actually activates vitamin D as well through the exposure to UVB sunlight, which, you know, the closer to the equator, the higher the UV index, the more UVB radiation that you're exposed to. And sunlight itself, it produces serotonin, you know, when it hits the retinas, your body produces serotonin. It knows it's daytime. It knows it's time to be awake. And later that serotonin is methylated, if you're healthy, into melatonin, which, you know, is very potent antioxidant and helps us sleep at night. And there was a recent study that came out, Alex, that separate from vitamin D, sunlight exposure actually changes the microbiome to more positive outlook for most people. It will, you know, increase Firmicutes, which most people recognize lactobacillus as being one of the strongest probiotics. It is a Firmicute, and decrease gram-negative bacteroids that can cause a lot of inflammation, similar if very heavy amount of population or dysbiotic, similar to H. pylori. Sunlight is one of the most things that anybody can do for free within reason. You know, I don't want people to get burnt. For me living in North Carolina, for example, at midday, if I'm outside wearing shorts and a short sleeve shirt, I can get the amount of vitamin D I need in 15 minutes. It's hot, and I sweat, but I get it. So
what about magnesium? For me, I have to tell you, magnesium, very simple, inexpensive, was like a miracle drug for me. It was one of those things where most of the time supplements, people won't immediately feel a huge difference. I did with magnesium, and I know you recommend it to a lot of your patients.
Yeah, majority of people are deficient in magnesium, possibly 80% of the population. We don't get in our food sources as much anymore. Ancient man mainly got their magnesium from mineral water, which a lot of us don't consume. Magnesium is one of the cheapest things. I have a good blog on magnesium on fixyourgut.com, a six-parter. Usually I recommend for most people, as long as they don't have kidney disease, about 200 milligrams per 50 pounds of body weight. I use magnesium malate for myself. There's many different chelations of magnesium. Malate, the extra malic acid in the magnesium works very well, increasing mitochondrial output and function, increases energy. So I take it in the morning, you know, makes me feel very good. Of course, you had suffering from AFib, and one of the main causes of AFib is possibly magnesium deficiency.
Okay, let's move on if we can. I try a lot of different stuff and have just because why wouldn't you? You know, I mean, there's a whole other dimension that I want to talk about later in terms of the spiritual versus the material. And should we even, you know, what is our relationship with our body versus our soul, our spirit, our mind, even our consciousness? So there's a lot to pull apart there. But I did want to kind of get personal, if I can, and just throw out some of the stuff that I've experienced and want to hear your thoughts on it. And the first one I'd start with is breath. I'm a long time done yoga for a long time and got introduced to breath work there. But, you know, really in the last year or two, I stumbled across the Wim Hof breathing. Phenomenal. I mean, immediate measurable results that just are undeniable. Anyone can go to Wim Hof breathing and learn about it very easily and do it. In your first session, you'll notice a difference. And there's other guys out there too that have breathing programs. But what of your investigation to breathing? What do you think?
I recommend the Buteyko breathing method myself, but Hof's breathing method is fine too. I actually, when I had asthma, it was one of the few things that the allergist told me to do to help with my asthma was pretty much the same type of breathing methods. Breathing exercises, they did work very well for asthma. I mean, extremely well. The main way it works for digestion, I guess I'm going to put a little spin on breathing so that, you know, I'm the fixture gut guy, so I'm going to talk about it as far as digestion is concerned. Is most people who have digestive issues, they have an underactive parasympathetic nervous system. Your parasympathetic nervous system is called your rest and digest part of your nervous system for a reason. Through your vagus nerve, it controls a lot of your MMC or your migration motor complex, the peristalsis of the movement of your digestive system. And proper breathing, you know, if you're breathing, you know, from your diaphragm, you know, proper inhalation of oxygen, proper exhalation of carbon dioxide, it will activate the vagus nerve. And slow breathing will activate the vagus nerve. And in doing so, it will increase the efficiency of your digestion by activating the parasympathetic nervous system and restoring proper migrating motor complex or peristalsis waves or actions within the digestive system. Because when our bodies are in a state of oversympathetic nervous system, you know, if you're really anxious, you're really full of anxiety, you're really full of adrenaline, taking a lot of stimulants like nicotine, caffeine, And you're, you know, some people might suffer from adrenal fatigue. They have this overactive sympathetic nervous system state. They're, you know, most people like that, including myself and probably you to some degree, Alex, we suffered from poor digestion because of that, because we didn't have proper parasympathetic, proper vagus nerve regulation, you know, controlling our digestive like it should be. So yes, breathing does play a big component from a digestive side into helping with that.
You know, but Wim Hof is such an interesting character for me, first of all, because he's really just a yogi. I mean, he's such a yogi, and he even talks about that a lot, but he doesn't come out and associate it with any of the things that he does. But anyone who knows yoga will get that. But he's taken it a lot further. I mean, he's a guy who's gone in and subjected himself to medical tests where they've administered endotoxin bacteria, and he's just controlled his autoimmune system, which you're not supposed to be able to do. That's why they call it an autoimmune system. But go ahead.
But you can do it, though. You can control it possibly through activation of the vagus nerve, through grounding and controlling your heart rate variability. You can somewhat reduce inflammatory side. I mean, he does it through, you know, cold thermogenesis, for example, which would increase mitochondrial output, which would reduce oxidative stress. I mean, there's many different methods of what Hof does to be able to reduce those cytokines like H. pylori that we both have produced. And his methods do work very well for that. You are correct.
But here's the twist on that always gets me is like, yeah, maybe that very materialistic scientific explanation holds, and I'm sure there's an aspect of that. But I think there's something else at play as well. You know, a few years ago, I interviewed a guy, really interesting guy. His name is Dr. William Bengston, and the doctor, he's not a medical doctor, but he's a very highly regarded sociologist, and he really understands the scientific method. And I'll kind of make this story kind of short because so many people have already listened to the interview or are familiar with his work. But here's a guy who stumbles across healing, hands-on healing. And he's just a scientist, so he's just curious. He's like, wow, mm-hmm. I never thought that would work. And he's working with this guy who is the healer. And it's almost like a cocktail party thing. The guy says, yeah, I can heal people just by putting my hands over them.
Reiki.
Well, fast forward to the point where Bengston is actually doing a laboratory experiment with mice who've been injected with cancer, and none of these mice ever live past 27 days, thousands and thousands of these, and he cures these mice. And he says, at some point I had to say that they're cured. They weren't in remission. They were actually cured. So we can say Reiki, or we can put any term we want on it. We don't know what's going on when we cross into this other aspect of the whole being, you know, and but we don't know from a, you know, if consciousness is fundamental and as that's yeah. creating our material world or all the rest of this. So I'm always a little bit hesitant when people jump in like with Wim and they go, oh, well, that's because he's doing this and this and that. No, man, he's just some crazy Dutch guy who was experiencing unbelievable grief because his wife had suicided, and he's walking yeah. along the street and he says, damn it, I don't know what to do with my head. I don't know what to do with my life. There's a frozen lake there. I'm not going to drown myself, but I'm going to go jump in the lake. And he goes and jumps in the lake, and you know what? That little voice inside his head stops. Even if it's only for a minute, it stopped, and he came out and he felt better, and he said, I got to follow this. So yeah. here's a guy who isn't really into the medical stuff. He just says, I can do this and I can teach other people to do this. And I wonder if we miss something when we try and get too technical with the slide rule science, you know, the slide rule science where we're just going, well, it must be this, it must be this, it must be this. When at the edges, we realize how little we don't know when we really look at the broader spectrum of, be it Bengston or what Wim Hof does, or, you know, somebody who has a near-death experience and as part of the experience goes through a healing of a some other ailment, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of those stories. They go on and on about them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, doctors, I mean, they believe that if you can make yourself sick, like I think it's called like a Takotsubo cardiomyopathy or broken heart syndrome, where the heart can weaken itself literally from severe mental stress. So they believe in that, but yet they don't believe that possibly from a spiritual standpoint or a metaphysical standpoint or whatever you want to call that, a person could will themselves to get better. I've known it to happen, and it's happened, you know. And I do try to look at things as in a logical mindset. Don't get me wrong, but I know with your past discussion that you had with Jason Lee. There you go. He was pretty much like a science, 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 science. You know, and if you go against that, then you know, we'll lead it to the dark ages.
Yeah, but the thing about Louvre is he's a practicing magician, supposedly, who's conjuring spirits to do his bidding. So.
But that's the thing is got to serve some master, you know. Maybe he's getting someone, you know, whispering in his head to pull the stuff that he does. That transhumanism is going to save us all, you know. And you got to look at it both ways. There's so much, like you're saying, and I agree with you. Like with Abel, I try from my logical mind to try to give a medical conclusion of why he should have been able to spit out that too, but there is none.
Right.
There is none. So spiritually, he through manifestation of will or whatever you want to call it, happened. And I accept it for what it is. It's a miracle. I'm sorry if that offends anybody, but that's simply what it was. There's no rational, logical explanation for it. And these things happen on a daily basis. And that's what you're talking about, the stuff that's on the fringe that may never have an explanation.
You know, I always like this story, and I know it to be true because I heard it from Andrew Weil, you know, the famous complementary medicine guy, super rich guy from Harvard, who has an interesting connection with Timothy Leary and all that. If anyone wants to go back and look, he kind of is the guy who outed Timothy Leary and Ram Dass for using LSD off campus. I digress, though. Anyways, Andrew Weil has gone on to become one of the most famous complementary medicine guys and has kind of turned that into a whole huge industry for himself and for other people. And it seems like a good guy, but he says what he does consistently all the time with his medical students is he says, go to the library and I want you to just go to the medical journals and randomly pull off a study, a major study, where there was a life kind of threatening kind of situation. And I want you to look for cases of spontaneous healing that aren't explained. And he goes, you'll find them under the category of placebo effect or whatever. But in every one of those studies, you'll find spontaneous healing. Well, what are we saying there? We don't understand what the hell happened. These are people in the control group who didn't get any treatment, who weren't supposed to get any better, who got better. And so it's holding these two things at the same time, because John, I'm totally down, and I hope people get that. You know, I'm taking the magnesium. I'm doing all this other stuff to try and improve my chances for experiencing the best life I can. At the same time, I'm humbled by the thought of, who am I really, and what is my larger connection to consciousness? What is my larger spirituality? And I just think that's the challenge, is to jump over and squeeze this one as tight as you can and then jump over to the other one and hold on to that as well, because it just seems to be what's at play.
I agree. I mean, that's why I'm not 100% for things that are can be explained logically, and I'm not 100% for things that are strictly spiritual either. I'm kind of a mixture in the middle, and some people hate that with a lot of my beliefs. I'm kind of, you know, thinking that, you know, both sides, there's some merit to it. But I do agree with you, Alex, that a lot of people try to just discredit things that they can't explain just because they can't explain them.
Okay, let me come back to the practical world, because I have a couple other ones that I wanted to just throw on the table there. One is fasting, intermittent fasting. Again, for me, this is something I just kind of ran across, stumbled across, and wound up trying it and found it to be just really effective for me. And there seems to be some good science behind it. And that's like controlling all your eating to in a, like a 5 or 6 hour window during the day, and then not so worried about portions or what you eat, but just keeping it inside that window to give your digestive system a chance to rest otherwise. Any thoughts on intermittent fasting?
When used in the right circumstances for the right people, it can make huge benefits in their health, just like you. But when used incorrectly in the wrong person, let's say someone has taxed adrenal glands, suffer from severe adrenal fatigue, the intermittent fasting, the upregulation need of cortisol and adrenaline that's produced because of fasting could make them feel and make them much, much worse. So it really just depends on the person. For you, intermittent fasting worked very well. For me, because of the state of health that I was in, it did not work for me at all, and I couldn't take it. And it's like that with some people I've coached. With some people, ketogenic diets or intermittent fasting, you know, or cyclic ketogenic diets, any of those, work very well, and they thrive on them. And then other people, it destroys them or it makes them ill. They were not really too much ill from going on them on the first place, and they go on them sometimes incorrectly, sometimes correctly, and it leads them to become ill. So that's why I've always said, and there's why there's no fix your gut diet, quote unquote. No one diet is perfect for every human being. We're too different. We're different genetically, we're different epigenetically, our microbiomes are different. It's just impossible. Now, there are some diets that are probably better for some than others. I mentioned the perfect health diet, but for some people, it may be too many carbohydrates. I love the diet, perfect health diet, but I hate the name. You know, as far as it being the perfect diet for health. But, you know, diet is such a individual thing. It really depends on the person.
Sure. No, I think that's really good advice. And I would just add, for what it's worth, my experience is that what the fast five, the 5 hour window thing, and I'm not strictly hold to the 5 hour, I do about 6 hours or so, it just freed me up. It was like I had been brainwashed into this thing that, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and as soon as you get up, you have to eat. And I was never hungry in the morning, but I was like, okay, I guess that's what I'm supposed to do, you know. And then at night, you know, the whole ritual around dinner and stuff like that. And it was like, I so naturally fell into a diet that just felt better for me by someone saying, here's some data you might want to take in about eating just inside of this window. So I love the way you processed it, though, and I totally accept that. And you just know a lot more than I do about this stuff, but I wanted to throw that.
I am a fan of fasting. It can help a lot for many medical conditions. There are a lot of studies that show that, you know, there's a lot of studies that show that fasting can be very beneficial for the immune system and very, very beneficial for longevity. But there are possibly some studies that maybe around the corner in the future that fasting, when done into some people, may trigger a condition in the body where the body thinks it's starving, and that may be detrimental to healing. So, you know, it just depends on the person. You know, if you want to learn about intermittent fasting and cyclic ketogenic diets, I wrote a good blog about ketogenic diets on Fix Your Gut. The Bulletproof Diet is a good example of a cyclic ketogenic diet, you know, Dave Asprey. I'm not against them. I just think with everything, with diet, it's very personal, and people should be well-informed and try to figure out exactly what diet works for them.
I'll tell you one thing I wanted to hit on, and I don't want to ruffle too many feathers, and I certainly don't want to ruffle your feather. You're such a great guy, and you do such important work here. But I do feel like sometimes there's two parts of the free pass thing. You know, it's like, one, I don't want to give a free pass to people who don't deserve it. I heard you talk on weed, you know, marijuana a bunch of times, and hey, I'm all about the benefits of cannabinoid oils and all the rest of this stuff. But Jesus Christ, aren't there a lot of people who are now becoming addicted, dependent, substance abuse problem with marijuana?
I don't think it's ever really increased. I mean, I would push back on that. And I'd also push back, what's the most common psychoactive drug consumed in the entire world?
I don't know, alcohol?
No, caffeine.
Caffeine. Okay, but yeah, I'm not sure that caffeine really measures up in the same way. I'm okay with
that. Let's talk about it. Why not? Let's talk about why caffeine is psychoactive. It has killed people. There have been people who have died from caffeine overdoses. There have been people who have died from marijuana use. It's extremely rare. You know, some people have died from, you know, also being under the influence while driving. I do admit that. But caffeine, you know, there are overdoses, a lot of them not, you know, on purpose overdosing. There are a lot of people who get, you know, arrhythmia and conditions where they have to be treated for caffeine, you know, too much drinking too much caffeine. So caffeine is addicting, is it not? I mean,
I don't know. I never drank caffeine, and I just started drinking like one cup a day. Taking that out of it, I mean, I just take a common sense approach, and that is this. Look, most of us have smoked weed, and we know the effects, just like we know the effects of alcohol. And we know the effects of smoking weed every day, of getting high every day. Hey, man, it is not good if you're getting high.
No, it's not.
High every day, if you're getting high multiple times a day, you have a substance abuse problem. It's like we want to give people a free pass or say this or that. It's like, no, man, it's like anything else that becomes a problem in your life, it's measured by, can you just walk away from it, or do you need it? And if you're using it every day, multiple times a day, then it's got more control on you than you have on it.
But would you say the same thing about caffeine or nicotine? There's millions of people around the world who are dependent on it. Caffeine can produce some odd form of drug dependence. It causes headaches and withdrawal. Some people it's very hard, difficult for them to get off of caffeine. I'm just playing devil advocate here. I agree with you that there are a lot of people who use marijuana incorrectly, and it leads them to not contribute as much to society as they should. Just like
screw society. I don't care about society. I don't care
for their own personal life. You know, betterment of themselves. Is that better?
Maybe. You know, I think back to the Joe Rogan episode with Graham Hancock. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's like a classic. You know, Graham Hancock, who is this incredible author and has produced unbelievably great work over the years and is just a brilliant guy, no doubt about it. And he's there talking about his 20-year dependency on marijuana, and he said how it really had gotten out of control for him. And then he had gone down and he had done ayahuasca, and the ayahuasca spirit had fought with the spirit of marijuana, and people who are in the shamanistic kind of world say, yeah, these two spirits have long known to be kind of feuding and this and that. And anyways, the ayahuasca spirit says, hey, you know, you got to stop that. It's interfering with your life. So he comes back and he fires up the vaporizer, and he can't do it. He just can't do it. And he walks away, and he's just like, wow, you know, I really see that I had misused that substance, and I had come out of align with it from a spiritual perspective. Well, I don't know if all that's bullshit. I don't know about the spirits. I'm inclined to think there's some reality to all that. But at the same time, I am inclined to believe that there's some reality to that. I believe that we are engaging with something more when we enter that extended consciousness realm that is associated with psychedelics like marijuana and psychedelics like ayahuasca, and we are in this kind of alternative world. And I think people who don't appreciate that and don't come at it at least with some respect of that have a greater risk of becoming dependent, having an attachment that might not be the most positive thing in their life. I don't know what you think about that, but
no, I agree. I agree with you, but all I'm saying is weed, marijuana has a lot of medical benefits. CBD oil, it does. Trust me, I've used it in my own personal life and people I coach. My good friend of my business partner, his sister, who is alive today, I'm not going to toot my own horn, I guess, because of me. He says it, so I guess I could say it. And we said it before, but her seizures stopped dramatically because of CBD oil. So don't get me wrong, I understand what you're saying completely, that there are people who will abuse marijuana or use it. You know, it's natural, man. It's the same with psilocybin mushrooms, alcohol. People will use substances incorrectly and use it, and it's destroying their lives. Like I guess maybe I didn't talk about that with Greg per se because it's THC. But I do understand that there have been, marijuana has destroyed people's lives and kept them from their own personal potential. I definitely agree with you on that. But I do think it has a very strong medicinal purpose too. That stuff like alcohol has no medicinal purpose really whatsoever, except for maybe wine polyphenols, but you can get that, you know, the other polyphenols from other sources. But hard liquor has none. Other than it works very well as a good disinfectant and antiseptic. That's the thing is I get what you're saying, and I will back you up on that and agree with you, but I also do think it has a strong medicinal purpose. Thing is you can't – it's like ayahuasca. I've known – most people don't admit that ayahuasca – that they know anybody that's destroyed their lives. You know, people have got stories of LSD, you know, destroying lives and stuff, but I'm not going to go into details, but I know someone personally who went on an ayahuasca trip and they weren't really the same in a positive sense after that again. And I know a lot of people have had many positive results with it too. But it's with everything, you know, there's positives and negatives. Every single thing that we come in contact with everything that we ingest, with everything that we do. And you're right. Marijuana is no difference. For some, it could help them tremendously. For others, it could destroy their life. I guess that's what you're trying to get at, is you want me to at least.
No. You've totally given your position in a really articulate way. I'm not trying to pick on people who smoke weed, and I get the whole thing. And hey, there's no comparison between, you know, weed and alcohol. If you just had to pick one to use in moderation, pick weed. There's just no question, you know. But I'm always a little bit leery when I get into these discussions and people immediately want to, you know, lesser of evil kind of thing. It's like, how about having a healthy approach to just consciousness and where you take it and what you do with it and what your purpose is, but you're all about that. Are there any other vices out there that you feel like maybe vaping is another one that's really popular? I mean, vaping's not good, right? I mean,
nicotine does have some possible improvements to mitochondrial function on occasion and in memory and neurological function. But I mean, most of the chemicals in your standard vape, you know, like you wouldn't want to breathe in polyethylene glycol. You probably don't want to deal with the more quote unquote organic vaping like glycerin. But I mean, there is some minor medicinal benefit to nicotine use when used in moderation, but it's like everything else. You know, there's medicinal benefit to the use of opioids if you're in severe pain. That being said, you know, you don't want to go, you know, inject heroin. but, you know, when used properly, even caffeine, you know, even though I just harped on it for a while, it can increases alertness and increases memory and cognitive functions. It does have some possible health benefits, especially when consumed in the form of coffee. So it just to each their own, you know, for some people. Marijuana can cause problems like cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, where a person who smokes marijuana, some of the cannabinoids can cause them to vomit very violently, and they should not ever smoke weed. You know, so there are instances where people should medically, you know, stay away from weed, and there's some people medically should use it. It depends on whether you're using it for creativity properly or exploration properly, or if you're just using it to escape the world and get high. If you're using it for that, I don't recommend anybody use anything for those type of methods. I myself, I don't ingest anything. The only thing I might ingest occasionally is a little bit of caffeine in the form of dark chocolate. But I mean, I haven't done anything in years. I just, you know, drink water for the most part and sometimes juice. I don't maybe like the way that most drugs make you lose your sense of control.
Fair enough. I tell you, you've been very open and you have, I want to again stress to people that this guy knows so darn much that we can't possibly bring it all forward. And I like the way that in this interview, you've kind of brought it down, I think, to more of a kind of low tech level, because you can get off on these things in a way that is necessary. I mean, you've mastered it and you have to share that knowledge, but it can be a little overwhelming for people. That's why they need to go to the website, Fix Your Gut, where they can kind of pick and choose and munch on this stuff and think about it. But, you know, the last topic I wanted to talk about, I really wanted to kind of pull you in another direction and just something that's personally interesting to me. And that's the proposition of where medical technology might be taking us, not just in the hokey, controlled, phony medical science that we see, but the promises that are being made for the quantum leaps we might make with strong AI, with biotech engineering, with gene manipulation, and all that stuff that is right on the cusp of being real in a way that is exciting to a lot of people, but is also very, very scary and threatening to anyone who scratches below the surface,
yeah,
and then looks back at where we've come from and says, where the hell are we heading? So what do you make? I mean, you've taken, if you really look at it, you've taken kind of a, I was just saying you're extremely well-versed in this stuff, but you're taking kind of a low-tech science approach. You're saying, hey, man, here are some natural substances, a lot of times supplements that you can get that are just right out of there, out of nature, and you can take them and you can feel a lot better and you can fill the gap that medical science has created. Can you jump over on the other side and say, what are we to make of these just moonshot level advances that are being promised?
Well, I mean, the way I look at the world is probably a little bit negative. So I would assume that a lot of those technological advances, if you want to call it the genetic changes through CRISPR or transhumanism, they concern me. I mean, I'm afraid it's going to turn into kind of a future of like, I have no mouth where I must scream type thing, where if we integrate with AI and we live forever, if something goes wrong, if it's malevolent, how can we be free? You know, as long as men can die, as long as tyrants can be defeated, you know, men have the chance of freedom.
But doesn't a lot of that stuff just seem kind of inevitable? I mean, they are going to, it's like, if you think back, John, on the stuff that, you know, 15 years ago, and as soon as they roll out some, you know, baby that's going to be cured or some, you know, mother who has some life-saving condition, they can sell just about anything, you know, in terms of how it's going to help somebody, you know, a transplant or, you know, a biogenetic arm, you know, we go, oh my God, that guy lost his arm. And now we can do this. And not only that, but he can pick up a dumbbell three times his own weight. You know, I mean, there's just going to be a lot of that stuff that we're going to embrace, because from a practical standpoint, we're going to say, we're going to measure the pluses versus the minuses, and we're going to jump on board. And don't you worry that before long, we'll just be down that path, and unless you're a complete Luddite, you're just not going to be able to.
We already are down that path. I hold something in my right hand now that emits a lot of EMF radiation that most people, so majority Americans have, can track everywhere I go, can listen to me, and possibly can analyze my brain thoughts. It's called a cell phone. And I've accepted this quote-unquote mark of the beast a long time ago. Just because of the ease of use of being able to talk to people and send emails and look at the World Wide Web. So yeah, you have a point. I've accepted it. A lot of people have. A lot of people are probably going to accept a lot of things in the future, but that necessarily doesn't make them right. For example, you could ask me, and it's a tough question, so I'll ask it myself. My son, he could have been fixed through CRISPR. Would I have had that done? I don't know. A part of me wants to say yes, because he would have a better life. It wouldn't have to deal with his ailment. It would still be here today. Another part of me says that it could cause some unforeseen incident and could trigger something that could cause problems. I don't know. It's a tough call. It's a tough call.
It's kind of playing God either way, that I think a lot of people don't really fully embrace both sides of that. Either side you pick, you're playing God.
Yeah, but I think as human beings, we are made in the Creator's image. So, you know, our minds, our souls, our bodies. So if we look at it from that standpoint, then we play God, you know, to some degree through a lot of things that we do on a daily basis.
But isn't that problematic to say that in Creator's image? I mean, we don't know what Creator is, right? We don't know if Creator is an ET. We don't know if Creator is an AI. We don't know what Creator is. I believe in the hierarchical order of consciousness. I believe that to me is code word for God, but it's not like a God in the cloud kind of thing. But I'm not sure.
I don't either believe in the God. I believe that the Creator is unknowable.
So unknowable leaves open the possibility of ET, a layer of ET, a layer of AI, a layer of, you know, us being genetically modified beings that are just, we're already, you know, playing in that middle ground anyway. I'm just not totally sure that I'm comfortable, you know, resting on the, I just look at who came before me and that's how I should look in the future. I mean,
No, I'm not either. I look to the future too. I'm just afraid that how much soul are you willing to give?
I don't know. I don't know what that soul is.
And I can't answer that question either. You know, how much of what makes us human, what makes us us, are we willing, what makes us individuals, are we willing to give up the good and the bad? And another question I'm going to ask you, Alex, is you said that this is the direction that we're headed into, and it seems to be unstoppable. Is there a possibility that this has happened before?
That's where I'm going to. I mean, I think when we open up that possibility, or is it happening multiple times or an immeasurable number of times all
yes.
over the universe already? And is it some cycle that isn't even a defined cycle? Everyone's all just kind of doing their own thing, thinking, you know, I'm the ant in the anthill going, oh my gosh, we just had the biggest natural disaster in history because somebody stepped on our anthill, and the person who stepped on it was just like, hey man, I had to mow the grass, you know, sorry.
And I do talk about the use of technology too. For example, my grandfather used a red light LED, you know, red light LEDs and low laser LLT therapy on his low level laser treatment therapy on his hip both times. He broke his hips both times to recover. And the doctors told him both times that he would never have to walk again. Never be able to walk, even though the second time he had a full hip replacement, and he's 92 and can still walk. So I'm not going to say that I don't recommend the use of some technology, but I do believe that, and Jack Cruz talks a lot about this, that it'll be a long time in the future before we can ever replicate the exact power of the sun and the different wavelengths that it has available to us. Modern lighting does it very poorly through the use of fluorescent lighting or LED lights. You know, they don't work very well as far as their ability to mimic actual degree shifts and UV shifts and IR shifts of the sun that happens naturally throughout the day and the different benefits of each exposure to each thing. So that's my thing is it ever going to be better than what's out there? And I don't have an answer to that.
Well,
but I can tell you right now, it's not. It's not any better.
Right.
I can't tell you whether or not if we do have the technology to move worlds, if it will be used for benevolent purposes or malevolent purposes. I don't know. All I can know is most technology now, whether ignorant or not, is used for malevolent purposes.
Well, I think it does get back to this idea of being able to jump between these different worlds. And that's what I really like about your work. You know, we haven't even gotten into, John has a lot of well-researched opinions on some conspiratorial stuff that we haven't even gotten into, because his main thing really is this book, Fix Your Gut. And he's helped so many people with his work. And I think it's great. Our guest again has been John Brisson. The book is Fix Your Gut. You're going to want to check out his website as well at fixyourgut.com. John, it's been terrific having you on, and we might have to have another session and talk about some of that other stuff and really freak people out.
Thank you for having me on Skeptico, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to John for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I tee up is the one I kind of teed up at the beginning is, you know, why try so hard on health? If life is to a large extent predetermined, predestined, or controlled by forces that are way out of our realm, why do we spend so much time on health? I know it's a topic that a lot of us kind of wrestle with back and forth, but I'd be interested in hearing any thoughts you might have on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico Forum at skeptiko.com, where you can find all the previous shows available for download for free, and also other ways to reach out and connect with me. I have a couple of interesting shows coming up. I'm kind of on this new path, and you'll see it emerging. There are some topics out there that are really interesting to me, and I'm going to just pursue those as I do, just kind of follow my nose and go with the stuff that I'm interested in exploring, and then hopefully sharing it with you is something you'll find valuable. Until next time, take care and bye for now.